little bit the same schedule that we followed last week. We've done just a couple of songs to kind of get us going, but we're going to have the time of message right now, and then we're going to conclude with an extended time of worship that you guys are really going to love and enjoy. And I would challenge you to do this before I forget. Today, after this service, while you're kind of hanging around, we're going to have a baptism out on the north parking lot in the baptistry right outside these doors. And so we invite you guys to come and share and be a part of that. We'll be done by about 12:30, and you can get on to lunch. And also, if you haven't heard yet, we need some folks to kind of help out on the north part, on the south parking lot, to help us get the booth areas set up. And it shouldn't take that long. The trailer's already back there. All we got to do is move some stuff in place. So we need about 10 or 15 folks, just some strong lifters to help us move some stuff into place, some plywood and some of that stuff in place. And see Micah or Andrea, not this Andrea, the real Andrea. So anyway, I'm a little bit embarrassed about that. Not really bad embarrassed about that, but just a little bit embarrassed about that. So, well, well, I'm just saying. Anyway, guys, if you have your Bibles, you might open them to Exodus 35. And we're gonna kind of wrap up this whole thought process on the Mina Project. You'll remember back on in July, if you were here, I did a message called Challenged by God. It came out of Exodus 35. It was the story of God with the children of Israel, with the nation of Israel out in the wilderness, out in the desert. And God has given Moses the Ten Commandments, and he's instructed him on building this house of worship, what's called the tabernacle. It was a big tent, really, more than anything. And I don't know what you think of when you think of a tent, but you think of the Coleman tent that you kind of throw up out on the campsite, or you think if, you know, somebody who's doing really well gets the big, you know, like 8-person sleeps 8 tent, you know, the big igloo looking kind of tent that you can put up at the campground. When we think of tents, we don't think of something that's really, you know, all of that special. Well, the tabernacle is nothing like either of those. The tabernacle was really an incredible, incredible place. And I hope that when we get to the kind of the conclusion of this thought, you'll kind of follow me on that. But back in July, I introduced the concept of God telling Israel through Moses, okay, here's what I want you to do. You're going to take an offering. You're going to put the materials and the stuff together to build this. And even at that point, back in the middle of summer, we were kind of priming the pump to get you guys thinking about what we've been doing in regard to this project that we are concluding here today. And I realize some of us aren't quite ready for that to happen, but for the most part, we're gonna wrap up that thought today. There are four things, though, out of Exodus 35 that applied, out of the life of Moses, that apply to us here at the Heights Fellowship. And so I'm not going to re-preach that message, but I am going to kind of give you some highlights because I want to show you something that I hope will really impress you in a good way. In Exodus 35, Moses speaks to the congregation of the sons of Israel. He says, "The thing the Lord has commanded is this: take from among you a contribution to the Lord, whoever is of a willing heart, and let him bring it as the Lord's contribution." Now, even in the highlight verses that I'm going to give you today, I want you to notice the "for the Lord," "Lord's contribution," that kind of stuff, and see how God, and how through the spokesman of Moses, that God regarded that. This is something you're doing for the Lord. Verse 20 goes on to say, "Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel departed from Moses' presence." And you remember, if you were here, I told you there was no discussion, there was no dialogue, there was no debate. There doesn't seem even to be any questions. That these guys literally just kind of in stunned silence leave. And I think they're trying to figure out, how are we going to do this? What is it that God is wanting to draw out of us here? And they began to kind of mull that over. In verse 21, it says, "And then everyone whose heart stirred him and everyone whose spirit moved him came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting and for all its service and for all the holy garments. Then all whose hearts moved them, both men and women, came and they brought they brought jewelry, earrings, signet rings, bracelets, articles of gold. And every man presented an offering of gold. And so did every man who presented an offering of gold to the Lord. And every man who had in his possession blue and purple and scarlet material, hard to find in that time in history and in that place in particular. And fine linen and goat's hair and ram skins dyed red and porpoise skins. You remember we talked about the whole idea, you don't find many porpoises in the desert. And so to get a porpoise skin is a big thing. And they had to have a bunch of these things. And they're coming up with this stuff. And one of the things I'm going to ask you is, where did this stuff come from? How did they get that? Where they didn't, did they, was there a mall? Did they go to a strip mall? What did they do? What did they go on, you know, eBay? Did they go on QVC? How did they do that? Where did this stuff come from? And as you realize it, it's really incredible. It's really, truly impressive. And everyone who could make a contribution of silver and bronze brought the Lord's contribution, and every man who had in his possession acacia wood. They're literally hauling lumber around the desert. Thousands and thousands of board feet of lumber. Think about that. Okay? Brought it. And all the skilled women spun with their hands and brought what they had spun in blue and purple and scarlet material and in fine linen. And all the women whose hearts stirred them with the skill spun the goat's hair. And you see the idea of the people almost as a whole being active and participating in this. It wasn't something that they just hired people to do, and it was a kind of a passive thing on their part. It was very much active. They were very much involved in the process. Again, I draw a line. I draw a comparison to us here at the Heights Fellowship as we have asked you guys to participate in this project fully. And the rulers brought onyx stones and the stones for setting the ephod and the breastpiece and spice and oil for the lights and anointing oil for the fragrant incense. And you see just this vast amount, this expansive list of stuff that was involved in this process. And the Israelites, all the men and women whose hearts moved them to bring material for all the work which the Lord had commanded them through Moses to be done, brought a freewill offering to the Lord. Now, we get to the end of that. Those are the highlight verses. And we said this, that the reason that God included them is very specific and very strategic. Because up until this point, God had provided, protected, provided over and over and over. It had been God working, been God moving. But all of a sudden, it comes time to build the house of worship. And God says, I want everyone, I want all of you guys involved in this. God challenged them all to participate, and there's a reason. And the reason is, God won't worship himself. And because of that, he moves to draw worship from his creation. He moves to draw worship from his people. And in doing that, he includes them in that. What they did in this contribution, what they did in this offering, was every bit as intense a worship as what they would do when the project was completed. And there were four things that kind of emerged out of this look in Exodus 35 that God presents a challenge to the people. They were challenged. They were challenged in a very compressed time frame. We have been challenged. Understand that what we're doing here normally is about a 2 to 3 year process. But because of our circumstances, they've been compressed down into a very few months. And so if it seems intense, it is. It's a challenge. But secondly, that challenge should have prompted them, should have prompted us to a strong consideration. To think about, okay, God, what is it you want us to do? How is it, God, you want to involve me in this? Because I know you want me involved. Now, how do you want me involved? The third thing was then that kind of brought a consecrated, a focused response. They are replying, they are responding to God. And ultimately, as they follow through with that, God's will was done, the job is done the way the Lord desires. The truth that emerges then is this, that stirred hearts always find ways to give rather than excuses not to give. So how has your heart been stirred? Now, here's what their response looked like. It says they gave themselves willingly, that it was widespread. It was across the camp. It was across the nation, across the community. That all the gifts were not the same. Some people gave gold, some people gave stone, some people gave material, some people gave ram skin, some people gave porpoise skin, some people gave oil, and it was widespread. The gifts were not all the same, but their giving was enormously abundant. Now don't miss this. The task in front of them was daunting. And you're about to see how daunting it is. When we put a dollar figure to this here in just a minute, you're going to be blown away. Their response was very comprehensive in that not everyone was gifted to work, but all of them could give. And thirdly, the result was a matter of national pride, a matter of national prominence, a matter of national focus and attention. They had something that no one else in the world had. And here's the response. It says in chapter 36, verses 6 and 7, that Moses had to issue a command worldwide, nationwide, that circulated throughout all the camps saying, let no man or any woman any longer perform any work for the contributions of the sanctuary. Thus, and notice this phrase, the people were restrained. That's not a passive statement, is it? That's an active statement. They literally had to make them quit. Hey guys, stop. It's enough. Knock it off. End of it. Now, you know why guys like me have to stand up and make pleas to congregation Sunday after Sunday, week after week, year after year? Because maybe our heart's not as stirred as theirs was. And when the heart is stirred, it will find a way. It'll make it happen. And it says that they had to say, folks, stop. It's enough. Seriously. So how much was it? Let's put a dollar figure to it. And I tried to use today's dollars. How much gold? It says in chapter 38, as it kind of is giving an overall evaluation of the end, that it was 29 talents of gold, 29 talents and 730 shekels of gold. That translates into just under 2.5 tons of gold. It's 44,800 ounces. Okay, what about the silver? Well, the silver, it says in verse 25 of chapter of Exodus 38, was almost 5 tons of silver. That's 153,600 ounces of silver, to be exact. And bronze. Bronze, it says, was just under 3.5 tons of bronze. 107,000 and change ounces of bronze. So what are we looking at? I went online and checked the markets to find out how much this would be in today's dollars. And I hope you're staggered by this. Gold, Friday afternoon, 3:30, 4 o'clock, is almost $61 million worth of gold. The silver was almost $4 million worth of silver. The bronze, you don't find a spot metal price for bronze anywhere. So what I did, I took the tin and the copper and made an alloy price. I kind of averaged those together. But it comes out to almost a quarter of a million dollars worth of bronze. Add that all together and it's just under $65 million. And that doesn't include the precious stones, the skins, the furs, the oil, the incense, all of which were exorbitantly priced. They were incredibly precious in those times. I mean, a pearl is so rare to be found that it was among the most valuable of commodities in that world. You add all of that together, you put it all together, it's upwards above $70 million. Now imagine if I were to come to you guys and say, listen, Heights Fellowship, here's what we want to do. We want to build this sanctuary. We want to build this worship center, and it's going to cost $70 million. You guys would look at me like, are you crazy? Are you nuts, Martindale? Let's find out what we can weed out here. Let's kind of pare this thing down a little bit. You begin to understand how daunting, how intimidating the task that God set before these refugees from Egypt. And you began to get an appreciation for their response. Now, some of you guys talked to me this week as I was kind of marveling. I never put a number to it before. I was blown away. The truth of this story then comes down to this. It's not a lesson about giving. It's definitely a dissertation, though, on living. How are you going to live in the light of this kind of challenge? And the importance is that it connects our lives with God's plan. Now, how are we going to be connected to the plan of God? Several truths. First of all, we understand then that God is definitely the world's greatest giver. I mean, think about the things that God has given us. Just kind of process through these. I mean, this is the list I came up with. It didn't take me very long to come up with it. You may have, you know, 5 or 10 or 12 things you want to add to it, and they'd all be applicable. But you look at the things God gives you and I. But there are several I want to highlight. In Lamentations 3, Jeremiah is writing during the destruction of Jerusalem. I mean, the Babylonians are taking Jerusalem. It's just being beat to pieces, and they're about to carry people off to captivity and to exile, and it's a bad time. And listen to what he says. He says, the unfailing love of God. How you doing, buddy? You feeling good? Good. The unfailing love of the Lord never ends, and by his mercies, we have been kept from complete destruction. You understand that the only reason that you and I are not completely annihilated, that we are not obliterated, that what our sin demands as far as our sentencing and our punishment not being carried out right now, instantly, is the mercy of the Lord. That's the only thing that holds this together. And Jeremiah said, by the mercies of God, we have been kept from complete destruction. Secondly, God gives us protection. In Deuteronomy 33, at the end of their time, as they're about to enter the land of promise and kind of receive the inheritance that God promised Abraham, God says through Moses, listen, God has always been your defense. His eternal arms are your support. And he has driven your enemies out from before you and told you, destroy them all. In other words, you have victorious living only through Christ. So God provides us protection. And ultimately, he gives us a spirit, it says in Timothy, of power and love and discipline. You know what that means? That you have the inner resources through the Spirit of God to live the life that God calls you to live, to avoid the things that you need to avoid, to do the things that you need to do, and to have the heart that you need to have. God provides all that. You can't outgive God. The result of that understanding, though, is this, that God owns it, God gives it, and God sees it. In the minor project, we talked about that parable out of Luke 19 where the master gave the minas. The master saw that he owned it all. He gave it to them. And then when he came back, he saw, okay, what have you done with it? Now, here's the question that I ask. Where did the Israelites get $70+ million worth of stuff to build a worship center? Well, God gave it to them. Well, when did he do that? When they left Egypt. You know what the scripture says? It says that when the nation of Israel left Egypt, they plundered them. The Egyptians were in such a panic to get the Israelites out of the country, they were giving them stuff to leave. And the stuff that they gave the Israelites, stuff that God gave the Israelites, he used to draw from them to build place for his worship. Now, translation. Where do we get this stuff? The stuff God has blessed you with, he desires to draw back from you as a place for his name to be made known, to establish his worship. You see the parallel is incredible. The second truth then is not only is God the greatest giver, but you will never outgive God. They gave God back the stuff that he had given them. What did they get in return? Think about this. God gave them protection. God gave them direction. And God gave them his presence. That's pretty big. I don't know that you can put a price on that, but to have the presence of God protect you from the Egyptians, to have the presence of God protect you from all the militant, angry people whose land you were going through on your way home, that's pretty, that you can't buy that cheaply. He gives them his sustaining provision. He provides food for them. He provides water for them. He provides light for them. He provides all of those things for them. He gives them ultimately a whole new way of worshiping. Nobody in the world had what they had when this was all done to worship. And ultimately, he gives them, as they go into this land of promise, a new home. Now, I would say, okay, who got the better deal here? Israelites or God? I would say the Israelites came out very, very good in that deal. I mean, here's a list of some of the things that he gave them. But think about the sustaining provision thing. I don't know if you've considered this. Over in Deuteronomy 8, 40 years after they've been wandering around in the wilderness, listen to what God says through Moses. The Lord humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna which you did not know. Now stop right there, because that's rich. Why are some of us struggling financially right now? Why are some of us struggling physically or emotionally, or you just find yourself kind of in a state of struggle right now, and you pray and it stays day after day? Why were they hungry so the Lord could feed them with manna that they did not know? Let me just kind of submit to you, part of the process, part of the reason that you're going through that struggle in life is that God is going to provide for you in ways you never considered. He's going to resource you by means that you never have thought of, that he's going to supply you in a way that you've never thought possible. Whether it be physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever. And God's aware. See, he hadn't forgotten you. He's not mad at you. He doesn't hate you. He did this to the people that he loved because he's drawing out of them this trust, this awareness that he provided in ways they would never expect. Look what it says. Nor did your fathers know that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone. And this is where that verse comes from. Jesus quotes that to Satan in Matthew as he's being tempted. And we understand it comes out of this concept of God's provision so that we understand, listen, the thing that sustains us is what comes out of God's mouth. And if God has said, I'll take care of this, he'll take care of it. It's an amazing truth. And it comes out of not anything else other than the idea of giving. Man doesn't live by bread alone. Look at verse 4 there at the very end. This is what drew me to this verse originally. And I kept backing up going, oh, that's good. Oh, that's good. Oh, that's good. Look at verse 4. Your clothing did not wear out, nor did your foot swell during those 40 years. Your stuff stayed together miraculously. God kept it all together for them. So he was constantly providing for them. And all he asked of them is, give me your stuff. Then we're going to construct this house of worship. A third truth we see then is that everyone is a giver. The question is, to what? And some of us are paying exorbitant interest rates on credit card debt. Or we're kind of flitting our money away in places that it doesn't need to be spent and wasting it. We're a giver to something. The question is, to what? So consider this, that churches grow warmer through fellowship. The blood begins to flow as we fellowship. And that's the whole point of life groups and of things where we get together and of doing life together the way we talk about is all the idea of fellowshipping with one another. Churches grow deeper through discipleship. Churches grow stronger through worship. Churches grow broader through ministry and they grow larger as they reach out. That's why I say, and folks, understand this. I'm standing before you as one who used to have all the licenses and all the degrees necessary to be a financial planner. You will not find a better investment than in the local congregation. And that's why it's always been God's intention to bring it there. I know there's a lot of other stuff out there that's good, but this is the greatest return in investment you will find. God asks us to give back and bring back. And the wrinkle in the plan is this, that you only grow closer to God as you give. Now consider this. 2 Corinthians 8, and these are all familiar passages. And so what I did, I tried to find maybe some non-traditional wording for that. And so I've used a lot of different translations and paraphrases for the last part of this message, just so you hear this stuff fresh for the first time. 2 Corinthians 8 is all about giving. 2 Corinthians 9 is also as well, because we're going to be in both of these chapters. But look what it says. It says, these believers in Macedonia who were giving in an incredible rate, it says that it was their own idea. They caught us completely off guard, and it explains that what they first did was they gave themselves unreservedly to God and then to us. Have you given yourself unreservedly to God? I mean, maybe we need to step back and say, let's don't look at our giving level. Let's look back at our giving ourselves to God level. Where am I at in that? Because when you do that, several things happen. First of all, you bless other people. It's said of these guys in Macedonia, out of 2 Corinthians 8, it says, listen, they gave themselves to God, and that joy, the result of that was, it says they had a severe trial. They were going through a bad economy. They were going through a tough time. They were going through bad circumstances. It says it welled up in rich generosity, and they gave to others. So you're going to bless other people with that attitude. A second thing that happens is you start thinking like God. God is a giver. The God who gave his only son is a giver. Look what Hebrews 10 says. Let us see how inventive we can be in encouraging love and helping out. One of the things we challenged you guys to do was get creative. And some of you guys have been enormously creative. I mean, the first day, I got this photograph from one of our folks. And you remember when we gave out the minor project money, we said, we're not giving it to children unless parents think your child is up to it, and then we will give it to you and you can direct that. Well, one of our moms sends me this deal, and this is what her kid did. This is what her child did. Took his $5, and he went to Sam's and bought a box of candy and set up a booth out in his front yard or somewhere and began to sell the candy for a buck a piece. He turned a 500% profit in one afternoon. Isn't that cool? That's from a child. One of our men said, well, let me tell you what I did. He took his $5 and he bought a one ad. I said, you bought a one ad? He goes, well, I bought a for sale ad. I said, why? And he goes, well, God told me to sell my car. No, are you serious? He goes, yeah, that's what God told me to do, so that's what I'm going to do. And people began to get creative. Maybe for the first time in our lives, we thought, man, what can I do with what God has blessed me with to really bless the kingdom? And they began to get inventive because God has made us enormously creative. He has given us great ideas. And I think the greatest sadness of life is that we spend it and we waste it in education and we use it in business and we use it in pleasure and we don't use our creativity and our inventiveness for the kingdom of God. Who knows what could happen if we extended our creativity into that realm too? And yeah, I'm passionate about it because we have been gifted enormously by God, and maybe this is the first time we thought about it. How cool is that? It prompts us to ask the question, what would the master do? You remember in the story of the miners, how the master came back, and one guy said, listen, I had no creativity, I had no real resources, so I stuck it away, and I hid it and put it in a napkin and tucked it away. And he said, why didn't you at least put it in the bank? Come on, man, get creative. Some of you guys have been enormously creative. We look forward to hearing the stories in the days to come. We start thinking like God. Thirdly, we bless, we find ourselves blessed, and we don't do it necessarily to you know, if then kind of thing. If you do this, then you're going to be blessed that way. We do it, and the blessings just flow down on our lives. Paul wrote to the Philippians. He said, listen, you know, I don't seek the gift for the gift itself, but that the profit which comes would increase on your account. You're going to be blessed because you give. And so the question is, what kind of blessing do I want? Do I want a chintzy blessing or do I want a lavish blessing? 2 Corinthians 9 in the Old Message paraphrase says this, remember, a stingy planter gets a stingy crop. A lavish planter gets a lavish crop. And we understand this idea that it's something of a proportion. God asks us for a proportion back. We start with the tithe. And it's not that it's that 10% is God's, because the truth of the matter is, it's all God's anyway. It always has been. Who gave the Israelites the stuff they came out of Egypt with? God. What did he ask them for? He asked them for whatever part of it was back. But it amounted to $70 million+. You begin to understand the scale of God's people giving what they have proportionally when they can. When he has said, listen, it's time to do that. The second part of 2 Corinthians 9:6 says, I want each of you to take plenty of time to think it over and to make up your mind as to what you will give. What kind of blessing do you want? So the principle of portion. Second thing, the principle of intent. And this is that old verse about, listen, you know, what kind of giver am I going to be? It says in Proverbs 22 that he who has a generous eye will be blessed. How do you see things? Do you see things to take, or do you see things so that we can work a way to give back and make our world a better place, to make the church an effective tool in the hands of God? 2 Corinthians 9 is that verse, listen, the cheerful giver verse. The Message says it this way. God loves it when a giver delights in the giving. Do you delight in what's about to happen here today? Are you excited about what God is going to do here today as we bring this harvest in? And the third thing is the proximity principle, which basically teaches this, that you are blessed many times in the process of planting, in the process of working, in the process of sowing. You receive a blessing even in the midst of that. It answers two questions. Question number one, what if I don't have enough? But it also answers the question, how much is enough, or how much is too much? And let me show you what I mean by that. As we read on in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, it says this, God is able to make all grace abound to you, that always having all sufficiency in everything. Notice all the alls. Notice all those kind of statements just in that first phrase of that verse. That having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. Verse 10. Now he who supplies the seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness, and you will be enriched in everything you do, for all liberality through which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. There's an old, old proverb that says this, that when a sparrow sips out of the river, the waters don't recede. In other words, giving never diminishes wealth. Folks, some of you guys are going to laugh at me. No laughing. Okay, I actually teach people to ski. It's one of my favorite things to do. And there are two reasons that people don't become skiers. The first one is they ski up to the edge of the slope and they stop there and they look and they get intimidated. And because of the steepness of the slope in front of them, they panic and they fall down. And they just can't get there. The second thing is, once they kind of slide out on the hill, they begin to move and the speed begins to bother them. And so they just kind of lean over and fall on a hip or fall back, and they kind of panic there too. And if they can ever get over the intimidation of the slope and the speed, they can slide down the mountain with anybody, because that's all it is. I mean, it's just sliding down a mountain. It's just sliding down a hill. When we get past the concept, we get past the fear that if I give, I lose. If I give, I don't have. If I give, I reduce, I minimize my wealth. And understand that the waters don't recede when the sparrow takes a sip. Then all of a sudden it takes us to a whole nother level as a believer. A whole nother level in trusting and following Christ. verse 8. I asked you to notice some things about it. I just want to talk about the 8 for a second. It says God can give us all grace, that God can provide all sufficiency, and that God can do this so that we may abound in every good work. The word all there, pasan in the Greek, literally means thoroughly, whatever, whoever. It's an all-encompassing kind of statement, which is by design. It means the whole. And so when God's talking about it, the answer is yes. You mean he can work that out? Yes. That he can cover that? Yes. But I didn't say what it was. Doesn't matter. All. The whole. The term abound in the Greek literally means to superabound. It's kind of an exponential phrase. Means to take it up beyond anything that you could expect. And it's used actually twice in this verse as a special emphasis within it. It talks about quantity. It also is a consideration of quality. It talks about enormous excess, that your little investment, however small it may be, reaps a multiplied result if you will trust God with it. The term sufficiency, though, is my favorite term in this verse, because the term sufficiency means self-satisfaction. And the idea here is that you are content, that you are satisfied, you are wholly and completely happy about the result. It's not, it could have been better. In fact, you come and talk to me after any church service, I'll tell you, yeah, I like this, I like that. But, that could have been better. I could have said that differently. I could have not said that at all, and it would have been better. I could have been, longer. I could have been shorter. I know you guys are going, no, you can't be longer, Martindale. You're always too long. But you could be a lot shorter. Don't amen that. I heard that. Anyway, but it's an idea. It's the idea of contentment, of being satisfied. You know what the cure for materialism is? It's be satisfied by giving and connecting with the plan of God. And you find yourself completely content. The old Phillips translation says this way: after all, God can give you everything you need so that you may always have all sufficiency, both for yourselves and for giving away to other people. In the Message paraphrase, it reads, God can pour on the blessings in astonishing ways so that you're ready for anything and everything, more than just ready to do what needs to be done right now. It talks about, it just gives you the sense of, listen, this is bigger than just the immediate need. 2 Corinthians 9 in the New American Standard, it says, and you will be enriched in everything for all liberality. You want a plan to return to do and to have and to be what you need to be. This is the plan. God does this more than any other reason that I know of, so that you will be able to give more abundantly and more often. And we cheat ourselves out of that opportunity week after week after week. We find ourselves blessed. The fourth thing is this: we bless God. God is blessed when we have this kind of heart. It says in verse 12 of 2 Corinthians 9, for the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, it's meeting a need, but also flowing through many thanksgivings to God. People connect it with God and they are thankful to him, because of the proof given by this ministry will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ. People make the connection. God did this. God's a part of this. God's the one who generated this and then should get the glory from this. And then he goes on to say, as he winds up, while they also by prayer on your behalf yearn for you, because of the surpassing grace of God in you. You bless God because he uses you to meet needs. You bless God because it multiplies by exponents, thanksgiving. You bless God because it causes others to glorify God. You bless God because it proves that Jesus is right and true. And ultimately, you bless God because it brings God's people close. There is a tightness. I'm excited about this because you guys are working together, doing stuff that you never thought were possible. I mean, last week we had a big dinner because a group of Mine of Money people got together and said, okay, we're going to provide a dinner. And people stayed around and eat. People from the community were coming around to eat. And people were in it together. You see what it created just from that small act? And that's happening over and over and over. We're excited about today. It's an indescribable gift that God has given us through Jesus Christ and his plan to grow us to be what we want to be.